kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO. It's almost 11 o'clock. Time for the food show. Today, Rachel, Chris, and Peter are waiting to speak with various guests, and we'll get to them in just a moment. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And it's also been made possible in part by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information can be had at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, because people need food.
Welcome to the Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel.
I'm Peter Jove.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Today, I've got an interview with an author from Italy. Well, she was originally from Canada, Jeannie Marshall. I was going to read off her bio on her website. But she's worked as a freelance journalist in Berlin, Madrid, New York, and also in her hometown of Toronto. Before moving to Italy, she spent 5 years as a features writer in the Life section of the Toronto-based National Post. In 2002, she moved to Rome with her husband, where she wrote this book.
And then we'll be closing the program with an interview with Mary Weaver Chapin, who's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. She recently curated the Feast and Famine exhibition, which features food-related art and is currently on display at the PAM.
And first, we'll hear an interview I conducted with Lara Pacheco yesterday here in the studio. Last year, Lara opened Seed and Thistle Apothecary, growing herbs in her garden in the Coley neighborhood and wildcrafting herbs to sell in herb shares. Similar to community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, she created a CSH, community-supported herbalism. I talked with her about her herbal background, her travels, and Seed and Thistle Apothecary.
So,
well, while that is coming up, it's interesting. We talked on the last show about some varieties of herbal and medicinal plants, and we're going to be excited to hear a bit more about the varieties that she grows and sells with through her apothecary. So here it is.
Sorry.
Oh, it's not quite ready yet. Well, maybe we could talk about how was everybody's weekend? We got a lot of sunlight. Did anybody do any work in the garden?
Well, I do know that we have at our place a lot of food growing right now. We've got greens, we've got herbs, and we are now ready for Lara Pacheco.
So Lara, welcome to the studio.
Thanks.
You started Seed and Thistle last year, a community-supported herbalism project rather than community-supported agriculture. So do you want to talk a little bit about Seed and Thistle?
Sure. So it's a monthly herbal CSA. You kind of made that reference. A lot of people still don't know what a CSH is. But it's basically a subscription of items that come from my yard, from plants that I grow or that I ethically wildcraft from our surrounding forest. And then within that model, I have two different options. One option is where it's general, so every month people subscribe for two herbal preparations, and it's seasonally based. And then the other option is it's customized, and so that means I do a consultation with a person, gather their background, their story, and then whatever presenting conditions a person has, and then based on that, I provide really every month herbal preparations or plants that kind of match their condition or issues that they're dealing with. And then over time, with that customized apothecary, I do a check-in every season to see how those issues are going, and then also what are things that they are liking or that they dislike. And then I do individual consultations separate from the herbal CSA, and then I sell at farmers markets, and then I do a lot of workshops and classes. So that's it in a nutshell.
So you started Seed and Thistle last year. What inspired you to start it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I've always had a love for herbs and a way of life where you're more connected to the land. You know the landscape, you know the plants. And then also, you know, things that can help us aid our bodies and the wisdom that already exists there. I think the herbal CSA model I liked because, you know, I want to still be able to, in my practice, be in touch with growing plants, making the medicine, but I also want to have a direct relationship with people as well. And so developing a more deeper relationship with my community where people are developing awareness of the landscapes around them, knowing the plants, and then making the connection between the plants and people, and how there's certain plants that are allies in a way that can help somebody in like situations or conditions. So that's really inspiring for me. I mean, every day, as well as I sort of develop more relationships with people and see them develop an awareness about their bodies, but also certain plants in their lives and that they notice growing around them.
What does your background in herbalism look like?
Well, you know, you could go as far as back as being a kid. I never really grew up with knowledge of plant medicine. There was no one in my family that knew, although I guess I hear more stories that my grandmother practiced herbal medicine in a way, but I never got to like learn any of that. But I was always drawn towards like, you know, sitting in a field of grass and noticing that there was like wild onions that I could eat. And then, you know, over time, like as I started traveling around the world and started observing that people in other places were practicing this, I was more and more drawn to that. I started working on farms, and that was sort of my attempt, again, to reconnect to the land, learned knowledge that I feel like has been lost in a way. And then by that, just on my own, I started reading books, kind of learning how to identify, and then reading books about, okay, how do I make a tincture? And then I started thinking more seriously about schools, and so I was always drawn towards the landscapes in the Northwest. I did trail work back in 2005, which was a way for me to live kind of in the wild and learn plant medicine better. And then I came back again because I saw a school called the School of Traditional Western Herbalism, where Matthew Wood was one of the main teachers, but you also had a sort of collection of different teachers from all over that were big names in the herb field. And so I did that program. I think I started that in 2011. And I finished that last year. It's a three-year program. So more or less, that's kind of how it sums up my experience.
Were there any experiences that you had traveling that were particularly striking or inspiring?
Yeah. One in particular I like thinking about was, well, and this also connects for a long-term vision of a project I want to get back to at some point in my life, but I lived in Costa Rica at one point as a part of this oral history project. And so I lived with this woman named Margarita, and the whole point of it was to gather stories of her life to see, because this area in Costa Rica was in Monteverde, like the cloud forest. And actually this woman lived in a small village called Cabaceras, and the area was developing pretty fast. And this woman named Ilsa, who started the project, her attempt was, how do we gather, you know, women's contribution to this area and turn them into maybe children's stories so that kids have an understanding of the sort of history of the place before it gets developed. And so my job was living with this woman, Margarita, and gathering her life story. And through living with her and gathering her stories, we went through, at one point we went to her childhood home where she grew up, which was like definitely in the middle of nowhere. And I was with her sister-in-law, and I became very ill. And it was so interesting to see the narrative of like the therapeutics they applied to me, because their first attempt was like allopathic medicine. So they were trying to give me like pills and things, which I was like pretending to take. I really like that didn't sit well with me. I felt really sick. So I didn't take those, even though I pretended like I did. I still wasn't better. The next thing was the sister-in-law. At some point, this woman from Chinese medicine background taught her some type of massage, and so she tried, like, employed that on me, and it was actually really intense. I don't know if she was doing it correctly. And then finally, their last method was, it was like their traditional medicine that they all grew up with, and it was like a tree sap of some kind. And so they gave that to me, and that actually helped. Yeah, it was just kind of, I was so intrigued by the narrative of just all the different things that they tried on me, because that presented to me all the different exposure that they had from different cultures and what was happening. It was sort of like a telling of what was happening in their own place. But also the one thing that seemed to sit really well, and interestingly that they tried it last, was this like medicine, this type of folk medicine that they had grown up with.
Did you learn a lot about different traditional medicines while you were traveling?
A little bit. You know, certainly I spent some time in India, and there was a lot of Ayurveda. There was also a time when I went to northern India, so that was like crossing into like Tibetan medicine. And I did go see a woman, and I was kind of given these like pellets. I can't really explain it. You see it a lot in Chinese medicine, actually. But I didn't get to study it, you know. I was always interested. I was also doing other things at the time. I was interested in this project of, under an umbrella called like traditional environmental knowledge. So ways that people were living that had subsisted them for thousands of years. So I was kind of like documenting a lot of different projects. So I didn't get to focus on medicine, but that's exactly kind of a part of this longer term project I want to undertake, is traditional like medicinal knowledge. And even trying to do that in the context of Portland, you know, in my neighborhood in Coley, it's very diverse. I know that there's a lot of people there that have a lot of knowledge from all the different countries they come from. And so I want to work with, there's a lot of emerging garden projects developing. And so I want to do some educational stuff with that. But I don't want to necessarily come in there as if I have all this knowledge, because I know that there's a wealth of knowledge in my community. So maybe turning that into some kind of, again, oral history project where I'm gathering, you know, letting people share stories of some of the knowledge that they have from their own places.
So this is the food show. How do the herbs that you grow relate to food? Are there certain ones that you can eat? And I mean, I guess nutritionally they are basically providing the same function as a food.
Yeah, so, no, that's a great point. I mean, that's what a lot of the plants you can definitely eat. For example, like calendula, You can incorporate calendula flowers into salads. And sometimes, honestly, depending on when, you know, when you're dealing with a condition someone has, food, you know, actually giving someone plant medicine as food is maybe the best thing that you could be doing for them. Because sometimes, let's say, tinctures, which I love to do, can be too harsh on the body. So if someone's really in a state where they need a lot of nourishment, things like ghee. So I like to incorporate plant medicine into ghee. I'll infuse it in a way, and someone could use it actually to cook with, or use it to apply on the skin like I do with cottonwood ghee. So that's another way of incorporating ingesting food in a nourishing way into the body medicinally. Like I said, you with the calendula flowers, you could put that into a salad along with dandelion greens. There's also people do a lot of kimchi with medicinal plant parts. So that's another really great way to incorporate plant medicine into food. Nettles is one of those like superfoods. You know, that's medicinal, but it's really great to, you know, throw it into a soup or make a tea out of it. Yeah, vinegars. I really like to do herbal vinegars too, which I kind of see as a food that you could use as a dressing, or just, you know, take shots of it too.
What does your garden space look like?
It started to feel a little wild already, which I was surprised this time of year. I feel like that doesn't happen maybe till May, but maybe you just forget every season, which is good. But it sort of is always this balance between chaos and order. It's a lot. There's different, you know, I have like rows where I'm growing, you know, annuals and vegetables. But then there's a couple of places, like, for example, I have one bed that's just like perennial herbals that could easily take over. But it's great because I'm constantly sort of cutting it because I'm drying and processing them into teas or tinctures. Then there's also this like native area that's sort of where it feels like you're in the forest in our yard. And that's where I like place some trillium, wild ginger, things that you would find in our forest here. And then there's also this one little section that has like lady's mantle that's kind of really small and hard to grow, and where there's some angelica, so it's a little bit more shaded. So there's kind of already these like little microcosms of different growing environments for different types of plants, and they all have their own personalities too. That's kind of a garden in a nutshell.
Is there a particular herb that you're experimenting with or really particularly excited about?
Yeah, that's a good one. It's exciting this year in terms of, you know, I'm starting a lot of different seeds, a lot more than I did last year. There's Zhao Gulong that I'm really excited about just to see it grow. It's also plant medicine that I think is amazing. It grows like a vine. It's in the adaptogen category, which means it works on the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, which sounds really complicated, but really it just helps the body deal with stress or manage stress. And it tastes amazing too. There's also ashwagandha. It's also another adaptogen. Just exciting to see that grow and what it looks like as a plant. We'll see, you know, once I think I'll keep the Zhao Gulong in pots, but maybe I'll put the ashwagandha in the garden. The pots make me feel like I have a little bit of more imagined control over, you know, if the weather changes or when it gets cold again, I can bring them back inside. Those are two plants I'm really excited about. There's also St. John's wort, which is, you know, a perceived weed, but I'm trying to get that going in my yard just so I can use that as a resource to teach people, but also so I can harvest that a lot because I use that plant medicine a great deal.
What is the CSH going to look like for this next month?
Yeah, so we have a spring tonic tea blend, which is, you know, a lot of violet leaf because that's growing in great abundance right now. There's also dandelion, which everyone sees everywhere. That's growing in great abundance, and that's also cultivating the root to the leaf, just because so we get all the bitter components to it. And to help the liver, which is especially nice this time of year as we transition. And then I have some yarrow, which is bitter. Again, that's good to have that into the system this time of year, really any time of year. Some raspberry leaf and nettles, of course, which is growing in great abundance this last month. So we're getting a lot of nutrients and minerals, which is great, again, for this time of year. And then something new possibly I'm trying to experiment with is, because I'm trying to do a lot, there's only so much I can do. And I'm trying to maybe collaborate more with friends in the community that are also medicine makers. And I have friends at 13 Moons Apothecary that make really good salves. And, you know, I don't necessarily make salves. That's not my specialty. It's more time. So I'm looking into and, you know, checking in with my membership or people that are members in the CSH, you know, how do they feel about what if I, you know, had some salve from my other friends so that that way it's supporting other people and that way I'm not, you know, getting stretched too thin and I can kind of focus on the other things that I'm doing. So in that case, it would be a salve and a tea blend for this month. So that's what the CSH is looking like for April.
So you recently had a workshop based on spring cleanses and shedding winter stagnation. Is there some information from that that you could share?
Sure. It's interesting with, well, it's great that you said the word cleanses, because a lot of the class was exploring the concept of detoxes and cleanses that are really popular, I feel like, in the public sphere. You kind of see it on like bulletin boards everywhere, maybe like in yoga studios, coffee shop. And I wanted to examine what are, you know, people's notion of that word, because sometimes I think it's misleading. I think cleanses sometimes can actually be very harsh on the body. It's forcing the body to do things that aren't necessarily very good, especially depending on your body type, your constitution, your body's needs. And it's interesting with the word detox because our body is naturally detoxifying all the time. So we kind of, you know, it was a quick education on what organs are doing that, how are they doing that, and what are ways we can help that happen in our body in a gentle, nourishing way rather than forcing, which I think of when I hear the word cleanses. And so that, you know, that's through diet, but that's also, and especially like this time of year as we're transitioning from winter where things can be more stagnant and slow, we're going into spring where things are kind of starting to unfold, expand, kind of what we see happening in trees especially. So I was kind of talking about what happens with sap this time of year, where it rises, it's, you know, it's faster, it's thinner, whereas, you know, in the fall and winter, it starts to sit low and it's thicker. And so ways we can do that, you know, is through plant medicine, and which we see growing around us this time of year, which are nettles. They're very nourishing, full of minerals. Also things like dandelion that, you know, for example, I have in the CSH this month, that kind of are stimulating to the liver, but with other things like violet leaf, which are nourishing and mucilaginous, so it has, it's not drying to the body. So this full combination that's going to first nourish us and then help us eliminate, you know, help those organ systems do what they're already doing. So the assumption is our body has this wisdom. How can we help that wisdom do its work without forcing it in really intense ways? So that's what the class was about.
So if somebody wants to become involved in your, in the CSH Seed and Thistle, how do they go about it?
Sure. They could, well, for more information, they could look at my website, which is www.seedandthistle.com. You can also email me at lara.pacheco@gmail.com.
Do you accept visitors to your garden?
Yeah, I love visitors to the garden. And actually, I'll be doing a class again with Eaten Alive on July 20th. Our plan is to start at my garden, and then we'll kind of work with a couple of plants. Everyone will learn how to harvest the plants properly, and then we might stop by another neighbor's house and then kind of look at some other plants that might be growing there, and then harvest some plants. And then from there, we'll go to a barn and learn how to make medicine from those plants that, you know, are according to the time of year in summer. And then Paige from Eaten Alive will also do some, make some food that are appropriate for the season, share some recipes, we'll get to taste some things. So that's a great way to see the garden. But also, you know, if anyone's curious and wants to stop by, I always love taking people on walks around the yard and talking about the plants. So, yeah, just contact me.
Great. Well, Lara, thank you so much for coming in the studio today.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Yeah. And that was Lara Pacheco, owner of Seed and Thistle Apothecary.
Next up, we're about to have a live interview via telephone from Italy with Jeannie Marshall, the author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids. So I briefly introduced her credentials at the beginning of the show, but I don't think I actually said what the book is about. She talks about issues affecting kids' food from a personal, political, and delicious perspective. She takes a whole sentences just to describe the dishes that she was served and prepared herself, and also to compare and contrast the political things going on affecting food. So without further ado, I'd like to not describe what it is myself and let her do the talking. Jeannie, you're on air.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Jeannie, how are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. So the title of the book is The Lost Art of Feeding Kids. Why'd you choose to write a book about kid food? Why do you think it's important?
Well, it seems like we were talking a lot at the time that I was thinking about it, about the way that we eat. And it makes sense to think about, well, how did we learn to eat? We learned to eat as children. And, of course, while I was thinking about that, I had a baby. So, you know, I had a very, very a great subject to study, in fact. And it just seemed like I was living outside of my own culture, so it was all foreign to me. It was all different from what I was used to and how I had been raised. And I started to notice that, you know, when you have a baby, and so you have to think about, are you going to give them breast milk or formula? And then it's, you know, are you going to give them food from a jar, or are you going to stand there with your food processor and make food for them? There were all these decisions to be made, and yet I was here in Italy, and I noticed that they do things differently here. So I started studying what people do. I guess it was like I became a little amateur anthropologist and just watched what people do. And I realized it's very different from what we do in North America. And I thought maybe, you know, other people would be interested in this too.
Could you tell us in what ways is the food culture different in Italy than in America?
Well, I think the main thing is when they start eating, kids about 6 months old, more or less, with the first time that they have solid food, we North Americans usually just give them one food at a time, and it's mainly because we're worried that they might have an allergic reaction to something, so it seems very sensible. But I noticed that in Italy, they worry very much about making sure that the children like food, and they have to appreciate food, and they have to enjoy it. So their very first food that they eat is a broth, like a little soup that's made out of about 14 vegetables, it seemed to me anyway. The doctor gave me the recipe for it. So it's all these vegetables that you cook and you make a broth. And then if you give them that for the first time, it should taste really good. And then the next thing you do is you use that broth as a liquid to puree whatever you're eating for dinner. So whatever it is that you're having, you make it, and then you put a little bit in a pot and puree it with this broth for the child. And it was all about teaching them that they should like this food. They should enjoy it. It should be something pleasurable. It wasn't something, you know, to be feared. It was actually something, you know, to really like, to really, really enjoy it. I thought that was really an interesting idea because I was really schooled in a be afraid of it school, I think.
But it seemed like they had more of an enculturation sort of vibe in Italy rather than just a fear of allergies. Maybe there's an expectation that everybody will eat the same thing rather than have the restrictions.
Exactly. And they don't worry so much about nutrition as we do either. Oops, sorry, my dog just suddenly decided to bark. they don't seem to be, well, they worry about nutrition, but they don't go into it as much as we do. So it's always much more about pleasure than anything else. And I really found that to be a revelation to me that you could think about food this way as something, you know, pleasant rather than something to be worried about and to be gotten right. You know, it's more like if you follow the pleasure, you will get it right. But that assumes that you're eating real foods, you know, as the way that Michael Pollan has taught us to view real foods, as opposed to, you know, getting kid food from the store and, you know, going and buying things that are made specially for children that have nutrients for children, all of that sort of thing. So if you're just thinking about it in terms of real food, it is healthy, even if you don't really know what's in it. It's more or less going to be healthy.
Do you see a lot of different food in the stores for kids? When you go into the stores in Italy, is it a whole different world than here in America?
It is different, although there's shades of America certainly here as well. And so if you go into a supermarket, it's going to be much more like North America, but smaller, just ultimately less of everything. But if you go to, say, a traditional market, the thing that has always really interested me and first confused me when I first got here was that it's just raw food. You have to deal with everything. You have to buy vegetables and fruits, and then you have to do something with it. And you have to buy meat, and then you have to do something, or fish or whatever. You don't really see any products already prepared. And in fact, for me, I found that really interesting because I had to learn Italian really quickly so that I could ask, what do I do with this? You know, how do I cook this? What do I do? I learned all of these things from people as I was going along. But it's very different. I'm from Canada, but when I go to Toronto and I go into a supermarket, it's, you know, everything, rows and rows and rows of things already done for me. It's already prepared. Even though I didn't even think that I was cooking that way, I realized I was relying on those prepared foods to a certain extent. And then in Italy, it was just fruit, vegetables, fish, meat, cheese, olive oil. What do you do with that?
Does that affect the diversity of what you're eating?
Yeah, I think we eat probably far more rich diet now that we are here. And some of that might be just that there are certain things available, but they're cultural as well. Like there's a culture of foraging for food too. So wild foods are available. Even in the market, there are people who go out and they forage for all of these wild dandelion greens, a huge variety of them, and you can buy them in the market. Or wild asparagus, this is the season for it. In fact, we've gone out and picked it ourselves. Or there's something we eat for dinner tonight called agretti, which looks like grass. And when I first saw it in the market, I thought, I don't think I really want to eat that. It really does look like grass. But it's really good. It's really green. I have no idea what it is. I've never seen it anywhere else in the world. And you just cook it in boiling water, and then you drain it carefully and put olive oil and a bit of salt on it, and it's delicious. My son will eat a huge plate of this, you know, just because he thinks it's good, and it is good. So I think as a result of just being presented with all of these foods and then you figure out how to cook them, we eat better, even though, you know, I like to cook, but I'm not a chef. You know, I'm just a normal person in the kitchen with my pots and pans. But we eat pretty well.
I had a question, which was it difficult to get your son to adopt the food culture in Italy?
To adopt it? Well, not really, although he's experienced the food culture in Canada, and he's quite interested in all of the sort of things that are available that aren't available here. But he's very much immersed in the culture here, and he goes to an Italian school where they have the best thing. This is one of the best things about living here, is they have a lunch program, and so he eats two courses every day, and there are no choices at all. They send you the menu at the beginning of the week. The kids all eat the same things. They don't get to choose. So they have the first course is either soup or risotto or pasta, usually with a vegetable sauce or something like that. And then the second course is meat, fish, or cheese, or a frittata or something like that, and it's always served with a vegetable and a bit of fruit afterwards. And so they all sit around the table together and they eat this. So he's really kind of become very used to this idea in this culture and used to the way that everyone eats here. So that, in fact, when we go back to Toronto, usually once a year, there's a bit of an adjustment that has to happen. And it's not even completely just that there are more processed foods available. Certainly he sees those things, but just that we don't eat like we do in Italy. It's just different food and different tastes, and you know, even the vegetables taste different, so he has to deal with that.
I'm so curious. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I just find that interesting. So.
I'm just curious. I know that in the cafeterias at schools in the United States, I feel like lunch is just sort of in and out. They try to get you to move as quickly as possible. If I wonder how like vastly different it is there.
Well, certainly from my son has gone to two schools here, so I've really had a view of those, and I ask people constantly about this. So the two courses with vegetables is pretty standard, and they're just kind of given enough time that they need to eat, and they eat with their teachers as well. So it's a bit of time to you've gone from the classroom, now you're sitting around a table together, and you get to decide what to talk about. So they have time to sit there and have their first course, and that plate's taken away, and then they have their second course and their vegetables, and then they finish eating, and then they go outside. And usually, I've gone and watched them a few times. It takes about half an hour, you know, 25 minutes to 30 minutes. It's not a long time, but it's longer than kids in North America usually have to eat their lunch. And they can take longer if they need it, but mostly they, you know, they don't really need it. They just eat that, and then they have their chat, and then they go outside. It seems not that hard to do, really. It's just cultural expectations that make it seem harder.
Yeah, you know, I kind of wish that we could adopt similar practices here in America.
Yeah.
Like it seems that when we're rushed to eat, well, I know for a fact, like scientifically, there's a delay neurologically between your stomach filling up and you feeling that sensation of full. So I just think that, I don't know, I'm a little concerned that rushing people through their cafeterias, that could lead to bad eating habits later on in life.
I'm sure that does, too. And here, I think the fact that they don't feel rushed, they probably don't take so much extra time to eat their lunch, but they eat it in their own time, and then they go outside to play. And so they don't feel like they're being pushed through quite so quickly. I think that does probably have a psychological effect on how they see it.
What do you suppose are some of the reasons for this difference in our food cultures?
Well, you know, it's so hard to know, but in Italy, I'm sorry to say, but it's changing and it's really becoming more like we are used to in America, you know, with more processed foods, a lot more advertising of foods. And the one thing I think that really works in Italy, it's not just the actual foods that they eat, but it's the rules that they have about eating. So you eat at mealtime for children, they have two snacks a day, and generally you don't snack outside of those parameters. And you don't eat on the bus and you don't do things like that. But now I see a lot of advertisements constantly for foods and the idea that we're all really busy, busy, busy people and we have to eat on the run. And so far, I don't see so much of it. I still see when someone gets on the tram or the bus or the subway and they've got, you know, something to eat, a sandwich or something, I still see all the heads swivel and look at them like, what are you doing? You know? Which is something you would never really, in North America, no one would bat an eye at something like that. But I still see that there's a little bit of shock, a little bit of cultural shock that you would treat food so frivolously that you would, you know, eat it on the run this way. So I think it's just your expectations. And we've had some time in getting used to this idea that we have to hurry, hurry, hurry. We have to eat everything in a rush, and we don't have time to cook, and we don't have time to eat, and all of that. And I'm sorry to see that it is, you know, that idea is being introduced here for sure. But and if you come quickly, you'll still see what it's like, though.
Right. So I guess in that case, does there a propensity to take more time to eat? Is that just part of the way they see the world? Maybe I'm phrasing this wrong. Like, are they able to chill out and eat their lunch more slowly because they're not forced to by their culture?
I don't know exactly. You know, I've lived here for 12 years now, and I study them constantly. They don't know that I'm doing that, but I do. But I really find it fascinating that everyone has this idea about food. That there's a little bar that's next door to us, and we were going there because we didn't have an internet connection for a while. and you could go and have a cup of coffee. But then they kept saying, oh, come back at dinner time. We cook dinner. And I thought, where do you cook dinner? There's no kitchen. And I was worried that they meant they put something in a microwave. But they had one burner and one little stove, and they were chopping up zucchini, and they would make, you know, they would make this food, very quick, easy food, but also very fresh food. It was all, you know, real food. And I thought, that certainly comes from the culture. There were young people doing this. And I thought, that I think that just comes from being raised in a culture where food is important, the quality of the food is important. They don't really get too caught up about complex dishes. Things tend to be fairly, well, you can if you want to, but things can be very, very simple. You just throw some zucchini and olive oil and garlic in a pan and toss it around with some salt, and then you add some fresh pasta to that, and you've got dinner. It's delicious. You know, they don't really worry too much about, you know, I don't know, whenever I look at recipes that have more than, you know, five ingredients, I can't make them, I think. And I think that's partly what they're like here. Or we had a car trouble recently on the highway, and the tow truck driver picked us up, gave me a recipe for how to cook wild asparagus. And I thought, everybody has something. Everybody, they've just been so immersed in this idea that food is good and natural that I think it's just part of their lives, and they don't really think about it so much. So they don't come to it with the expectation that we have, that, oh, it's going to be hard, I have to make dinner. You know, they just, you have to eat, you have to do it, so you just do it, and it's a pleasure. And I think, you know, that's it's just an attitude more than anything, and certainly we can adopt that, can't we?
So we're running out of time here for our interview, sure. But before we let you go, what are some things that our listeners can do here to sort of adopt that viewpoint of food, to give themselves more time and to eat more deliciously and healthily?
Well, I would say not worry so much about nutrition, think more about pleasure, and certainly just, you know, don't make things too complicated, but just think about eating real food. Anything that comes in a box, just forget about that. So just think about real food, fruits and vegetables, you know, basic ingredients, things you have to do something with. Keep it simple, and don't complicate things. Like, you don't have to turn your kids into little food fussers who don't eat this and don't eat that. You just have this one basic category. We eat real food, that's sort of it. We cook it ourselves, or we'll eat at places where they cook themselves, and I think it slowly starts to fall into place. And everybody has to do it, though. That's the thing. That's the only way a culture works. It's collective. We all have to do it together. But each person who does it influences the people around them. And eventually, we'll have a food culture.
Well, thank you, Jeannie. You've been great.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, so that was Jeannie Marshall, the author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids. You can pick it up from Beacon Press and read more about it, because she does a really good job of spinning the political and the personal. She tells a story about how she herself raised her son, as well as focusing on some of the broader global issues affecting food in the world.
So we're going to take a short music break, and then we'll be back with Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. You are listening to the KBOO Food Show.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night. Straight. Beans. You better wake up or I'll gas you gate. Beans. Been in this pot since 2:30. Beans. Swelling and puffing and almost due. I'll be ready
to mad at night.
Beans. That's what beans told cornbread.
Beans.
Always get mad at me.
Beans.
I ain't mad at you.
Cornbread.
I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Beans.
I'll be ready.
Beans.
Beans grab cornbread by the toe.
Beans.
Beans said, cornbread, let me go.
Beans.
Cornbread said, I'll lay you low.
Beans.
I'm gonna fight you so and so.
Meet me on the corner. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
That's what
beans
said, cornbread.
You're so beans
bad, you always wanna fight. Meet me on the corner.
You are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. We are visited in the studio by Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. She recently curated the exhibit that is actually still at the art museum called Feast and Famine. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So give us a little bit of background to Feast and Famine.
Feast and Famine is a look through the graphic arts of food culture, how it's produced, how we enjoy it from about the 1850s to the present in Europe and America. So the exhibition features 66 prints. There's prints, drawings, artist books, all sorts of different media, some wonderful posters, all circling around this question of food.
And what were the initial conversations like leading up to creating the exhibition?
Well, I immediately thought of the pop artists, people like Andy Warhol with their wonderful Campbell's soup cans, Lichtenstein, all sorts of artists who were very playful, Klaus Oldenburg with their depictions of food. And so I started with the pop artists, and then I started sort of working backwards in time. And what I thought I would find were pictures of lots of happy families. I thought food is one of these things that brings us all together around the table. And so as I was going through our collection, I thought I'd find lots of depictions of people gathered around food, celebrating, enjoying, socializing. And instead, what I found was much more complex.
And sort of that sort of began the conversation. How did you piece together the exhibition?
Well, I started with the feasting aspect, and as I dove in and it became more complex, I realized that food was extremely political, even for artists. And so issues of, who has it, who doesn't, how we use food as a social lubricant, they all came together. And so I cast the net very wide. I probably had about 200 objects that I was working through. And then I narrowed it down into a few basic themes. So the earliest works in the show are by Jean-François Millet, working in Paris in the 1850s. He was looking at the peasantry around France. And that's really about food and labor, about how for most of human history, if you wanted to eat, that meant you were working in the fields, 14, 16 hours a day, planting, harvesting, working. And so that's sort of the first moment in the exhibition. We start with food and labor and then jump off to some other topics.
And I did get to actually visit the exhibition, and it was kind of like you, as you go through, you're in these little rooms that each have different themes. Really fascinating. And one of the ones that really stuck out to me was the menus. Could you talk a little bit about the menus?
Oh, yes. We have a wonderful selection of menus designed by artists. And these date from the as early as the 1880s to the present. And so artists like Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec and James Ensor, David Hockney, local artist Frank Boyden, have all created menus for either very small intimate gatherings or maybe a gathering that could be a little bit larger, say 100, 200 people. And it's a wonderful way to see how do artists respond to food in this very intimate setting. For instance, if they're prints, they may only make 3 or 4 of them, menus, these private menus for a dining experience. And what you see on the walls is that they're very witty and they're very playful. And to me, that shows some of the spirit we bring both to art and to food.
And I'm wondering how you've obviously gotten a chance to see people as they come through the exhibition. So how are they reacting?
Oh, it's wonderful. I try to spy on people as much as I can going through the galleries. What I find interesting is that there isn't one piece that people go and stand in front of. Different people respond to different areas. A lot of folks are very excited and curious about the posters we have in one of the galleries. There are posters advertising absinthe, beer, champagne, and then white and rosé and red wine. And for them to see, to make the connection between here is food as a commodity. I mean, these posters were there to sell the products to this growing middle class. And I think that is a great moment of awareness where we start to see in our modern world, starting about the 1890s, where we have so much of a surplus that there's this real need to create demand. And how do we do it? How do we sell food? What are our techniques? And then, as in today, it always works to put a sexy girl in your poster. So that's one area where people have been very interested. I also see people in front of the menus. They're quite detailed. The James Insor menus are very detailed, full of all sorts of scandalous little anecdotes. So I encourage you to go take a close look. And then people seem to have a lot of fun when they get into the area dealing with pop art. So there is one display of the Campbell Soup Company commissioned a paper dress, a disposable dress, covered, decorated all with these Campbell Soup labels. And back in, we think it was about 1965 to 1967, if you sent in two soup can labels and a dollar, you could get one of these dresses. So again, this intersection between art and food and fashion, and it's just this wonderful graphic oddity that people seem to really enjoy.
So I want to kind of take us into the conversation of what you're talking about, this like intersection of art and food. During this exhibition, there was also an eating experience that was hosted at the museum that featured local farmers, and it was sort of a conversation about food and farming. And so I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on the intersection of art and food?
Well, it was a wonderful evening, and one thing I really appreciated about meeting the farmers is that they seemed to be less hung up with this, our current culture where everyone sort of eats their own thing. And listening to the last interview, I was really struck about how children, they get what the parents get, and there's one meal for the table. And what I kept laughing about, this art event with food was all around potatoes, which can symbolize, you know, famine years or feast. But I also laugh because I have plenty of friends who now will not eat potatoes because I think they're on one of these bad lists about, is it glycemic index or something? I haven't paid attention to it. And I loved how the farmers were completely free from that. I mean, they know how things are made. They see it come from the soil. They were really, in a way, pure in a way that I think our foodie culture has gotten a little attenuated or mannerist in its treatment of food. And I loved their real direct experience with the ingredients.
Sure. And it was kind of like what Jeannie Marshall said about, well, don't worry about the nutrition, worry about the experience, worry about it tasting good. And that's the start to eating well.
Absolutely. And one thing that's come clear to me in working with this food exhibition is so many people have come up and said, this reminds me when I was trying to cook for my family for, you know, Christmas or Passover, that, you know, one's gluten-free and one's vegan and one's, I think we've lost a little bit of the communal aspect of dining.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about the venue, the museum as a venue for talking about food and for having these food experiences. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the museum does all sorts of wonderful outreach and programming. So everything from our very sort of traditional gallery talks where you might hear a curator or a docent or an educator talk to you about the art, to lectures from experts in the field that are a little bit further abroad. And so this was an example where we brought people who had expertise in one area and looked for those exciting connections where we could overlap. And I think those sorts of events are very popular. And in fact, this one sold out immediately. It was posted on Facebook and had a limited number of seats, and it just went by in a snap. So I think that our audience is hungry for, ooh, bad food metaphor. I bet that happens a lot here. For these different types of ways to engage with the art.
Mm-hmm. So you see it's changing. I feel like the role of the museum is kind of shifting and becoming more of a hub for conversation, a hub for social interaction, as opposed to a place where you can go see these things that have been collected and displayed.
Well, yes and no. I feel like the museum's always been that hub. I think what we have is a new set of vocabulary to talk about these sort of interactions. But Portland Art Museum is about to celebrate its 125th anniversary. And throughout that history, there have been all sorts of creative ways of getting people in to engage with the art. So I think this is the manifestation of our time, are these sort of programs. But it's wonderful. One of our employees in the education department is compiling this list of different sort of engagement activities we've been doing over our history, and lots of creative things from the past decades.
What kind of conversation came up when you had the dinner with all the farmers?
There were a number of conversation prompts that we had around the table. We were all seated together at a long table. And one of them was thinking about times when you have experienced hunger. And that was really interesting because we live in such an affluent society and many people hadn't ever experienced hunger. But there was a gentleman, an older gentleman sitting across from me, and he talked about when things were very, very tough for his family during World War II, you know, eating some of the animals on their farm that they had considered pets. And it really gives you some perspective. I know I've lived in a very comfortable world, but hearing people that you know or have a relationship with talk about what does hunger feel like? It's something I think many of us just cannot even begin to understand. So I thought that was really helpful. People also, everyone seems to have a funny food story or stories about sitting around the table with their families growing up. And it reminded me of how much of our culture is transmitted around those dinner time conversations.
Do you think that the Art Museum has been able to bring in sort of that dinner conversation feel? Do you think that that's added to the level of dialogue?
Yes, I do. It was a wonderful setup. We had the long tables really facilitated conversations, and it was a Friday night, and it felt festive, and it felt different. And I think that really put people in the right frame of mind. But I've also discovered, I've given lots of gallery talks to different groups and to the public, is that food is such a universal that almost everyone feels comfortable talking about it. You can talk to kids, you can talk to adults. Every one of us has a food story. And so this exhibition has been really easy, I think, for people to share and open up and relate what they see to their own experience.
I guess that kind of goes to the question of, and it seems like it will be from person to person, but what do you kind of see? What do you want people to gain? What do you want people to experience when they go to Feast and Famine?
Well, I hope they'll take the opportunity to really think about food through an artist's eyes and what can artists show us that we wouldn't think of on our own. And I think part of that is the playfulness. You see it especially in the pop art, how artists take a very witty approach to food and our daily need for sustenance. But it's also a very interesting way to look through the artist's eyes, to look at politics and the role of activism, and especially in the graphic arts. So you have artists like Keta Kollwitz working right after World War I, advocating for the poor, or artists like Sue Coe, active today, who really advocates for animal rights and how we treat our food. And so it's very rich that way.
So we are at the end of the show, but I want you real quick to tell us how we can engage with this exhibition.
Well, I would encourage you to come by the museum. It's on the walls through May 4th, Feast and Famine, The Pleasures and Politics of Food. And you can also find out a bit more online at our website, portlandartmuseum.org.
Great. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. Mary was actually also featured recently on a food story podcast called Underground Airwaves. You can check it out. You could hear her tell a story about a family fruitcake. It's a really great, fun story. And to find that, you can visit the Edible Portland website. So thank you for listening to the food show for April. I want to thank our guests, Laura Pacheco, Jeannie Marshall, and Mary Weaver Chapin. I also want to thank our awesome board operator, Tammy. Remember to tune in to KBOO every third Wednesday of the month at 11 for the food show. Stay tuned for some jazz on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel.
I'm Peter Schoof.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar
you're tuned to KBOO, KBOO Portland. Nick with Jazz is coming right up, and just after the KBOO news at noon.
And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protects them.
This is KBOO Noon News for April 16th, 2014. I'm Dan Johnson. The Russian flag was flown on armored vehicles by separatists today while trying to recapture towns controlled by pro-Russian forces in the eastern portion of Ukraine. Meanwhile, NATO reported it would increase its flights and ships to the Baltic region to quell Russia's threat to Ukraine. Kevin Kayvon Edson, age 25, was arrested by Boston police on Tuesday on charges of threatening battery, possession of a hoax explosive device, and several other offenses. Edson left a backpack near the finish line where the Boston Marathon is to take place next week. Police determined there was a rice cooker in the backpack and it was destroyed by authorities. Joey Edson, Kayvon's mother, said her son had